Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Vincent Yang, the host of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Michael Polshock about his new book, Power Structures in International Politics. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vincent. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what drove you to write this book?
Sure. Well, for work, I am a technology consultant at KPMG. And I should start by saying that everything we talk about today is my own view and not that of my employer. But I am a combination of lawyer and software engineer, and I work on technology projects that combine the two. So think of TurboTax, right? Someone had to take the tax law, put it into that program. I don't work for that company, but that's the kind of system that I help build. I guess on a more personal level, you know, I think one of my defining qualities is just being highly curious and always interested in trying to figure out how the world works and geeking out on history, technology, math, you know, all sorts of things. And that curiosity has really propelled my career. Started off doing humanitarian work in Kosovo and then became a human rights lawyer and then got into law and technology. And then, you know, along the way, kind of became obsessed with political power and what it is. I didn't start out trying to write a book, but I just became really intrigued by trying to understand what political power is and how it works and coming up with a model of it. And that is ultimately what led me to write this book.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about how this system that you've created for modeling political power dynamics works?
Yeah, well, I'll start by telling how I kind of landed on the idea. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I worked in Kosovo. It was right after the war there. It was a place where law and order had kind of broken down, and so much of what was happening was dark and violent and driven by just political power and the worst uses of it. And I just had this sense that there was a logic to the things that were happening, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but it made me really interested in history. And I just began reading more and more political history. And after years of doing this, I kind of felt like, well, every book I read, it's sort of the same story over and over again. You know, maybe the names change and the places change and the technology of domination changes, but it's you just constantly see actors struggling to obtain power, oppressing those who don't have it, those who don't have it fighting for it. Somehow there are networks of relationships involved, but I still couldn't quite put my finger on what this pattern was. And then one day, about 9 or so years ago, I was on the beach in Jamaica, just sitting by the ocean, and I started thinking, okay, well, what would happen if a little country like Jamaica and a big country like the United States went to war on each other, which is an absurd thing to think in. For any Jamaicans listening, I'm really sorry to have entertained such a thought like that, but I kind of imagine like the U.S. is this big circle on a piece of paper and Jamaica as this little circle, And okay, well, and there's a line connecting them. And so picture that in your head, because that's what I, when I say power structure, that's the image that I have in mind. So if those, like say those two countries are fighting with each other, you know, what happens? Well, the more powerful country is going to get a little bit smaller, but the smaller country is going to shrink even more. And then, okay, imagine they're getting along. Well, now somehow they're both helping each other get stronger. And I got really obsessed with this little kind of model, this diagram of the kinds of interrelationships that countries could have. And because I saw it, that pattern in, you know, different histories I was reading, that, but there was a dynamic to it that I didn't quite understand. You know, I wanted to know, if you have a power structure like that, how does it change? And part of what makes it change is the relationships among the countries cause some to grow and others to shrink in the way I just described. You know, if two countries are fighting with each other, somehow their levels of power are decreasing. And if they're getting along, somehow they're increasing. And so that's one process that makes them change. But then another one is each country has to figure out what its foreign policy is with all the other ones. And it changes its relationships. And I just got so obsessed with this concept. I mean, I spent 9 years of most of my free time, you know, when I wasn't doing normal human stuff, just trying to understand how this model could be refined to make it exhibit the kind of behaviors that we all kind of observe in the political world, in the international level, at other levels. And yeah, I just became obsessed.
Right. Yeah. I can totally understand that. What are some things you did while you were building out the model that helped you figure out what different subcomponents of the model were or helped you test it against the real world?
Well, you know, having a computer was a big help. And I don't know how I could have done it without, if I wasn't literate in computer programming, I don't think I could have pushed the idea this far. Because, well, Steve Jobs has that quote, computer is a bicycle for the mind. And, you know, it helps you, it helped me visualize things and it helped me see the consequences of the assumptions I was making. So I would, you know, start with this little power structure concept, and then I would try to program in, okay, here's what happens from one time step to the next. Press play and then see what happens. And if it did something unexpected, you know, maybe that unexpected thing was interesting, or maybe it was clearly wrong, and I would go back to those assumptions and try again. So being able to tinker with the ideas computationally helped me sort of grind it down to really a clear set of assumptions that I was starting from.
Right. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. One of the facets that I found quite interesting while reading your book was about the differences between having a foreign policy that allows a country to interact with another country relative to simply amassing power internally. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the starting points of this little model, this power structure model, is, well, what do the states in the system want? So I had to make some assumptions about what they want. Clearly, they want power. But there's sort of two senses that they could want power. One is they just want more and more and more of it. And I refer to that as absolute power. You know, they want their amount of power to increase in absolute terms. That's not really the world we live in. We also live in a world where countries want power relative to each other. And it's important that to some countries that the amount of power they have is more than their peers have. So they want power in that relative sense. And, you know, that tension between wanting absolute power and relative power, I mean, you could think of each state as having a preference along some spectrum for those two things. And those preferences really drive a lot of the behavior in this model. I should probably just step back and say, you know, for folks who are listening and maybe thinking about political power, like you might be imagining political power in the context of that, you know, someone running for president or Congress or a dictator in some country. And, you know, that is definitely a kind of political power, but it's a kind that exists in an institutional context. And in coming up with this power structure model of power, what I've tried to do is strip away all the variables that exist in the world except power. So taking away institutions, taking away law, taking away things like technology and the relevance of certain charismatic personalities, taking away geography, taking away, pandemics and environmental concerns. You just strip all that away. And what I think you're still left with is this fundamental thing, particularly in the international realm, which is raw power. And so the model is just about raw power in this sort of platonic sense. And because it's so abstract, it doesn't apply exactly to the way the world works, but it applies generally. So you can see the patterns that emerge from this model, because it's so abstract, you can see in many different contexts. So you can see these same dynamics in the domestic political context, but they work a little differently, because in the domestic political context, you have institutions, and institutions sort of constrain what the actors in the system are allowed to do and how they're allowed to use the power they have. In the international system, I mean, there's no world government that can enforce laws. There are other mechanisms, but it's closer to the model. But even still, it's not, I mean, I'm not saying this model is an exact description of the way the world works, but I think because power is so fundamental to international politics, and because this model generates the dynamics of power struggles, it is, it's a first approximation, right? It's like when, Newton's laws describe how a projectile moves, but they leave out air resistance. And so you have a first approximation, but if you want a more exact description, then you have to add in other formulas for air resistance. And then maybe it's a spaceship and you need to take into account, general relativity or something like that. But my approach was, what is the simplest possible way to look at international relations? Like, just take everything else away and just focus on the absolute simplest, most basic thing there is, and that's power.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I really thought that with being able to use this model in this way, it was really quite interesting to see all of the different dynamics that would emerge. For example, the different kinds of relationships that countries could have with each other, or the different incentives or values that they might have, and how they would go about chasing those. So how did you determine how happy, say, a country was with its current state, and what would determine its next avenues towards attaining what it wants?
Okay, well, I'll answer that, and I'll try not to go into too much technical detail, because, at root, this is there's a mathematics behind this whole thing, and it's computational. And in the book, I really made a great effort not to show all that, because people do not want to read math. So there's a one-page technical appendix that has the math, but everything else in the book just uses, pictures. And I tried to make it as non-technical as possible. But the gist of the answer is, each state wants some combination of absolute and relative power. And that is, they make decisions about what foreign policies to have, about who to cooperate with and who to fight, who to ignore, based on sort of the structure of the system, based on the shape of that power structure that I described earlier, that visual you can have in your head. And so every state is constantly reacting to that structure and changing their foreign policy. And in the process of changing their foreign policy, they're altering that structure. And so I use that idea, that preference for absolute versus relative power, and threw in some other concepts from economics, and came up with this metric that I call Prince Rank. And so you can take any power structure, and Prince Rank is like this little formula that will basically tell you how happy each node in the network is with its position. And that metric takes into account the whole power structure. So, say you're a little node over in the left, and you have happy relationships with with you, some other nodes near you, but there are, you know, other countries fighting across the power structure. Like, that conflict affects your preference. Your happiness in that structure is reflected by that, based on how much you like absolute power and how much you like relative power. And, you know, my I guess hypothesis is that Prince Rank captures what states in the international system want. Again, it's a first approximation. It's a complicated world. States want a lot of things. But if you just look at it in the most basic terms of their pursuit of raw power, I would argue that in a very simplified way, states are trying to maximize that metric of Prince Rank.
Could you tell us a little bit about how Prince Rank differs from just the raw amount of power you have?
Well, it depends on how much other people have, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, depends on your personal preference. And I say you as in you're a country in the system. But it also, you can think of power as something that flows around the network. You know, based on the relationships that states have with each other, some get more powerful, some get less powerful. So states possess power. That's when we all think of a country being powerful. That's what we think of. You know, they have a certain level of it. They have some number that expresses it, even if we don't know how to measure it. But I think what's unique about this way of approaching power is also dynamic. It's something that moves. You know, one country can deploy their power. They can allocate it out to help another country or to hurt another country. And so you can visualize it as flowing around this network of countries. And that flow is really how this Prince Rank metric, you know, it's based on that flow. I guess maybe you could summarize it as saying, you know, the more power that's flowing towards a state, the more happy they are. More constructive power, that is.
Right. People generally want to be moving upwards as mm-hmm. opposed to not. You've also touched on the importance of absolute versus relative strength here. And I'm wondering what kinds of factors play into a country's preference for absolute versus relative strength. For example, do stronger countries overall tend to have some preference, or are there other underlying patterns?
I don't know the answer to that. I think in the book, and as far as I've pushed this idea to date, I don't know why some countries would, you know, want to grow in absolute terms, just, you know, to want their material level of wealth to increase, and others are more concerned with what their peers have. You know, in the international relations literature, sometimes there's this term for revisionist power, a country that is unhappy with the way power is allocated in the system and they want to change it. So you could maybe think of a revisionist country as one that's more concerned about relative power. I don't know. I think it's a really good question. You know, are there structural factors that make one country want more relative power versus more absolute power? You know, if a country is feeling somehow threatened by their neighbors and defensive, maybe that changes their outlook, or maybe just getting more power makes you, you know, more concerned with getting relative power. And sort of that idea that power corrupts the more you have. I don't know the answer. It's an interesting question.
Yeah. One of the implications that I found really interesting from absolute versus relative strength was the different stable configurations that countries would tend to fall into. For example, some configurations or some states where countries could exist in with different amounts of power in between them would lead to some consistent outcomes, things like hegemon tributary relationships.
So it's really interesting to try to, you know, you look at this model, you program it in, you run these simulations. I probably have run thousands of them. And, you know, what happens when you set up a little situation and run it? What's the dynamic behavior that occurs? And, you know, one observation is, as you're describing, is there's a tendency for, if you have a really strong country and a relatively weak country, there's really no incentive for them to fight because the little one's not a threat to the big one. The big one has a lot to offer the little one. So they tend to form cooperative relationships. And, you know, if you have a really big state that has lots of those relationships with little countries, it forms a hierarchical structure, something that, you know, we could associate with an empire. And so the model exhibits this tendency for imperial formation. But at the same time, every state in the system also wants to be the center of its own little empire. And so these little countries, maybe they're lining up with this hegemon, but they don't like it. It's not the best outcome they want. They want their own little empire too. And so on the one hand, there's this, you know, stability in the relationship between a strong state and a weaker state. But it also gives rise to dynamics like the balance of power, where little states are trying to band together to oppose this stronger state from forming this hegemonic empire where it's at the center of this, you know, network. And it actually, in the simulations, it's very dynamic. And it took kind of a long time for me to figure out how, you know, what assumptions I needed to start from to let that dynamism emerge. Because if it wasn't dynamic, it really would not be a plausible model. You know, everywhere you look in the political world, things are always changing. So it's pretty interesting that by conceiving of power in this way and these starting assumptions, the behavior that just emerges naturally has the kind of dynamism that, you know, is reflected in the way that countries actually, you know, in some abstract sense, interact with each other.
What are some of the variables that you had to play with or set, or some of the relationships that you had to tune in order to create this dynamic state?
Well, I think the main variable is power. So each state has power, and they have power that they're, like I said, expending in their relationships with each other. And then there's some parameters around, you know, what is the effect of two countries getting along, or how much do they hurt each other when they fight with each other? But really the big breakthrough that took quite a few years for me to figure out was this analogy with game playing AIs. And I was really inspired by the work of DeepMind and the programs that they created to play Go and chess at a superhuman level and the algorithm behind it. And, you know, I sort of adapted a very simple variation of that to essentially let the countries in this model, I mean, it was like they're players in a game. And they're, you know, when you play chess, you make a move, and then your opponent makes a move, and then you make a move. But before you make a move, you have to imagine what your opponent's going to do, and you have to imagine that they're imagining what you're going to do, and you're sort of playing this imaginary game out in your head until you sort of find the best move you can make, and then you make it. And then your opponent does the same. Well, in a power structure, you can simulate that same sort of, you know, it's called a game tree. You can play out these hypothetical game trees, and then each country sort of selects the move that puts it in the best position, given all of the moves that have been searched. So that was really, once I figured that part out, and it took a long time to sort of hone it down, and there's all sorts of performance things to think about because there's so many moves that can be searched. It can take a long time to do a simulation. But that was a real step forward in getting power structures to exhibit this kind of dynamic behavior.
Yeah. In my mind, that's really interesting because I can think of empires and hegemonic structures where they have these tributary relationships. And I'm wondering about, in general, if they have these trade relationships with tributaries, then the smaller countries are still benefiting. And it makes me really wonder about what types of other factors might perturb the system to inspire the smaller countries to band together and rally against the hegemon.
Yeah, they are benefiting. I mean, it's kind of like the imperial center benefits, and in a way the tributaries, the satrapies also benefit. But I think, you know, they're sort of reasoning, well, I could be doing a lot better if I were the center of my own network. And so they're trying to form relationships with their peers, or maybe, I mean, and, you know, think of a real historical situation. There's an empire, maybe the Persian Empire, you know, 2 millennia ago, and it dominated kind of all of Central Asia. But there's still countries that are not part of the empire. They're on the periphery. And, you know, they don't like living next to this giant empire. You know, it could threaten them next. So maybe they're going to team up with one of the smaller states that's dominated by the empire and try to, you know, push back. And the system is constantly changing. You know, countries are, and states are, they're getting stronger, they're getting weaker. So it's very dynamic, and there are all sorts of opportunities for the smaller states to basically, you know, resist and try to counterbalance what this central hegemonic state is doing.
Mm-hmm. While you were running simulations, how often did you reach states where it was just eventually stable or consistent, like where you hit homeostasis?
Almost never. I mean, in the beginning of my investigation, I did, but that's because the assumptions that I was making were just, you know, they were naive. They weren't, it was kind of before I came up with this game playing algorithm that I was telling you about. But once, it never, and in the book, I describe it as perpetual disequilibrium. Power structures are just in constant disequilibrium, even in empire. You know, maybe it will have a general shape of seeming to last for quite some time, but it ultimately always collapses, just like in real life. I mean, empires always come to an end somehow. And there are sort of little microstructures that do seem to be stable, like the relationship between a large state and a small state in isolation can be stable. But the power structure as a whole is just seems to me to be continually changing. And I mean, it's sort of a disconcerting thought because, you know, we're all stepping outside of the international system in our daily lives. Like, we're all embedded in power structures and corporations and, you know, other institutions we're in. Plus, we live in a country that's part of a power structure. And, you know, you sort of have this childish wish for the world just to be stable. You know, like, can't everything just be predictable and no one gets hurt and everyone gets wealthier? But what the power structure model shows is that just doesn't happen. You know, again, in this first approximation of how power is, it's just too dynamic. And, you know, I think it just kind of reveals that part of the human condition is to live with this uncertainty and this disconcerting reality of continual change and continual possibility of loss.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I really liked how you brought it over to how power also resides within countries down to the personal level. And although there are abstractions made for the model itself, there are certainly still power relations within legal structures within a country, within a company itself. So I found that to be quite intriguing.
So, I mean, I'll just say a couple words about that. I mean, the image that I gave you at the beginning of you have this, you know, these circles on a piece of paper and they're connected by lines. You know, some lines represent cooperation, some lines represent conflict. Well, if each circle represents a country, I mean, it's a simplified view of the world. But you can also imagine taking one of those circles, one of those countries, and like zooming in on it. And if you zoom in, you see that each country maybe has its own power structure. And, you know, let's talk about the U.S. power structure. You know, what is that? You have government, tripartite system. So different branches of government, you know, could be nodes in this network. And then you have state governments and you have massive corporate power that, you know, in some ways dwarfs the power of the government. And then you have all sorts of institutions and nonprofit and civic associations that are sort of little micro dots in this power structure. And within each of those organizational circles, you can maybe even zoom in a little more, you know, and within a company, it has its own little power structure. And to some extent, that might reflect the organizational chart of the company, or You know, there's sort of informal structures there too. I think the more you zoom in, you know, the less it follows the dynamics that I outline in the book, because you have more factors at play. You have institutional constraints, you have laws, rules, personal psychology, all this stuff. But that's why, you know, the more you zoom out, the I think the closer I would expect the behavior to exhibit what this model does. And if you take it to an extreme, you could imagine, you know, say there was a galactic civilization and each country, each planet was its own, you know, this is own circle in this graph. And there was no galactic empire, no galactic government, then I would expect that sort of system to behave very, very similarly to the dynamics that the power structure model exhibits.
Yeah, it also makes me wonder about anarchist systems where you can just do anything you want, about what types of dynamics might arise when you have, say, for example, some smaller number of players, and how this might change as the number of players increases.
Yeah, so I guess the model assumes anarchy in the sense that it assumes there are no rules and there's no one to enforce any rules. And yeah, I mean, in an anarchy, you would have something closer to a raw power structure. You know, I'll just make one comment about, you know, I think there's a human tendency to think that power should be distributed evenly and that somehow that would be more fair. But we also, and, you know, I'm sympathetic to that too. And I'm not a proponent of power being centralized with one entity. But there is a kind of stability that comes from having one strong, you know, hegemonic entity, like more like Hobbes' Leviathan, than having, you know, some sort of society where everyone is equal in power and there's no one to sort of mediate between the two. So sort of heading into the terrain of the ethical implications of different kinds of power structures. And, you know, without taking a position on which ones are better than others, you know, what are the dynamics that happen in each? I think that if you have a power structure where everyone has the same level of power, I mean, it's not going to last long, because some of them will find a way to become centralized faster than others. And once they become centralized, they grow faster. And then before you know it, you know, they're fighting off rivals and you have a little, you know, a little mini empire going. And then the cycle repeats.
Yeah. What, after you made the fundamental model, did you find that you were able to add some variables back in?
Yeah. So in the book, that's the approach I take. The idea is, okay, first let's strip out all these variables I talked about before, personality, institutions, blah, blah, blah. Take it all out. Look at raw power. But I recognize that that is, in a way, a ridiculous simplification, oversimplification. And so, you know, what other variables can we start adding back in to make it a little more like the real world bit by bit? And, you know, there are ways you can add geography back in. So where countries are situated geographically in relation to each other, you know, that can have an effect on the way they act towards each other, the way they project their power towards each other. You know, you can introduce this idea of resources as something to be possessed that gives off a kind of, you know, power. Makes whoever possesses a resource is getting a boost. You know, things like this. You can also interpret a lot of other, like if you start from viewing power and the quest for power and these dynamics as sort of like the fundamental starting point, is like the operating system on which things are working. You can maybe imagine other applications kind of running on top of it, if you want to use a technological metaphor. Things like ideology and religion, institutions, you know, they all are, I mean, there's a lot to say about them, but in their own way, they have touch points with the power structure paradigm. You know, they are phenomena in which power is being agglomerated and allocated and constrained. And so, you know, you can introduce more subtleties into the model by taking them into consideration. But I won't say that I got as far as, you know, actually putting them into the simulations in the computer, but conceptually you can kind of see how they relate to this power structure concept.
Mm-hmm. Suppose someone were to come bring the torch forward in a way, if they were to continue building on your model, how do you imagine that they might do so?
Well, I guess a big part of it would be trying to understand how these other layers, you know, take that first approximation and come up with the second approximation and third, and having results that become maybe more realistic. But at the same time, what do you really get out of that? I mean, personally, I'm attracted to very simple models, and maybe that's just because of the limitations of my intellect. But when you look at things in a simple way, you sort of get to the heart of the phenomena. You know, you isolate it, you can understand that better. And maybe that's all you need. And adding other layers onto it, while it may give you better predictions, it doesn't actually help you understand the phenomenon much better. I think another way that someone might take this concept and run with it is to apply it to historical situations. Now, you know, I do not think that this model is going to predict the future. I mean, I'm not positioning in that way. I don't think the future is predictable. Even if you just look at a simple abstract power structure, you know, in a computer simulation, it is not predictable. Every time you run it, you get something different. There's sort of an inherent chaos to it. So, you know, I'm not saying you can put in sort of the modern international system and this view of the world is going to tell you what's going to happen in the future. I don't think it's about prediction so much as understanding. But nonetheless, it would be interesting to take different situations and put them in. I'll give you an example. About maybe a year and a half ago, I, as part of this academic paper I was writing, I took a look at Russia's war against Ukraine. And I wanted to predict, using this model, what would happen a year in the future, taking into account Russia's a much stronger country than Ukraine. It's like, you know, dumping all of this destructive power on Ukraine. There are sanctions applied against Russia. There are, you know, NATO countries helping Ukraine. And so I put that into the model and ran it forward. And what did the model predict? It predicted that Ukraine's power, as quantified by national wealth, would decrease by around 60%. And it predicted that Russia's power, as quantified by national wealth, would be about the same. And it may be too early to tell whether that prediction is correct, because it takes a while to amass accurate statistics, particularly when there's a war going on. People, that's not their highest priority, is to figure out what's our national wealth. But, you know, I think what we're seeing now somewhat resembles that prediction. Russia has, you know, its economy has not imploded. That's not to say the war has been good for it. I mean, if not for the war, it would probably be in a better position in terms of national wealth than it is now. But so, I don't know, maybe to some extent the model can have a little bit of predictive illumination, but it's not going to tell you when the war is going to end. It's not going to tell you when a war is going to start in the first place. But I think there may be certain aspects of empirical work that could be done.
Right. So in that case, what would you say is the significance of the power structural model overall? And how does it tie to other studies, perhaps, or other thought experiments, or other fundamental understandings about power?
So I think the significance is that it is a new conception of what political power is that exhibits the dynamic behavior of power over time, and that provides a template for looking at a lot of different situations in the international realm, but also beyond, as I described. And it's fundamentally quantitative, which I think is really interesting. I mean, the whole idea boils down to three mathematical equations. And again, in the book, I hide them in the appendix, so you don't have to ever deal with them. But the fact that from three one-line equations emerges all of this dynamic behavior that is reminiscent of the real world, to me, is incredibly fascinating. And so I think, you know, if there's significance, it's not so much that, oh, here, we figured out how the world works. Let's predict it. Let's, you know, use it to take action to figure out what to do next. It's more, oh, well, here is a coherent perspective. You know, here is a new way to conceive and understand the way the world works that has sort of an inner coherence to it. I mean, that to me is why I've been obsessed with it for 9 years. Because it's, you know, there's a beauty to it. And hopefully, you know, the book conveys that beauty without being so nerdy that it will scare people off.
Yeah, I really thought your book was quite well posed for a general audience, and you made everything quite understandable. So I really enjoyed that.
Thank you, Vincent. I appreciate you saying that. It took a lot of work.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. I just had one last question for you. I'm wondering what you're working on now, whether or not it may be related to continual improvements onto this model or other projects.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about this topic. My curiosity hasn't moved on to other pastures yet. And I'm interested in sort of other theories of international relations and how this view of the world dovetails with them or conflicts with them, how they work together. I mean, in international relations theory, you have realism, which basically says, you know, nation states are trying to amass power. You have liberalism, which says, you know, laws and institutions and cooperation is the defining feature of the international system. And then you have a bunch of other theories too. And so I'm trying to learn more about them and see how they all come together. And I don't know where I'm going with it. I mean, that's the thing. Like I'm always just sort of following my curiosity, and often it doesn't lead anywhere useful, but maybe it will. We'll see.
Yeah, that sounds like a great project and great continuation. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Please take care.
Vincent, I did too. Thank you so much for having me.